On this episode of Death Row Stories, executions around the country go horribly wrong.
It was clear something was not right.
He looked like he was trying to get up off the gurney.
You could see a spasm go through his body.
But when secrets emerge about government executions...
You've got people carrying cash in the night across state lines.
They want to create the aura that everything is smooth.
The question is asked, does it matter how we put people to death?
These are evildoers. These are animals. We want justice.
Who cares if he feels pain?
You are not allowed to experiment on people and killing them.
We've demonstrated again and again and again. We make these godlike decisions without godlike skills.
There's a body in the water.
He was butchered and murdered.
Many people proclaim their innocence.
In this case, there are a number of things that stink.
This man is remorseless.
He needs to pay for it with his life.
The electric chair flashed in front of my eyes.
Get a conviction at all costs. Let the truth fall where it may.
From the beginning of recorded history, civilization has sought justice through the ultimate punishment, death. And as societies have evolved, so too have their methods of execution. In ancient Rome, prisoners were fed to the lions in front of large amphitheaters of people. In Greece, the condemned were sealed inside a bronze bull, which, when set on fire, would pour smoke from the nostrils while the person inside roasted to death. In England, prisoners were drawn and quartered, with horses pulling people apart, limb by limb. France famously used the guillotine, responding to the chant, "Off with their heads." For a long time, the method of choice in America was hanging.
In the United States, the first recorded execution was in 1608 in Jamestown, Virginia. Over the years, hangings became a great social event, a great source of entertainment. People brought picnics. Teachers would bring the students, parents would bring the kids. There was a choir, a band.
Executions were public because they were considered a ritual whose goal was to deter the populace.
But our history of executions also included a dark side. Botched executions that quickly turned horrifying for the masses.
It turns out it's very difficult to properly hang somebody. If the drop was too long, the person's head would fall off. So somebody invented a machine where the rope would go up to a pulley and a boulder was dropped. They called it jerk to Jesus or launch to eternity. There was a man named Eddie Ives. Eddie weighed only 80 pounds. So the weight drops and he goes kazoom and twirled around the horizontal beam and came crashing down to the ground. They had to hang him twice. There was a lot of concern about botched hangings. That's why the electric chair was brought in.
By the late 1800s, electricity was transforming America. In order to demonstrate the incredible power of this new phenomenon, Thomas Edison filmed the electrocution of an elephant. Executioners quickly seized on this modern method of putting the condemned to death.
One of our first electric appliances was the electric chair. But the electric chair's got its own problems. Jesse Tafero was executed in 1990 in the electric chair in Florida. A lot of reasonable people do believe that he was innocent. There were 8-inch flames that erupted from the skull cap that Tafero had on during the execution, so he basically burned to death. In 1997, a man named Pedro Medina was executed.
Flame erupted all across the top of his head, like from across this way, from one ear to the other.
The warden of Florida State Prison was quoted as saying, "The flames, the smoke, the putrid odor, and his death by inferno plagues me still."
In 1977, lethal injection was invented in Oklahoma as a more humane way to execute prisoners.
Historically, executions were very ugly. Hangings, electrocution. And so one of the goals of the state now is that it looks calm and peaceful.
To a great degree, the lethal injection regime has much more to do with the witnesses than it has to do with the condemned. The witnesses weren't seeing the condemned writhe or cough or choke or snort.
The challenge with lethal injection was finding executioners with the medical skills to do the job.
Today in the United States, it violates ethical codes for physicians to be involved. So usually the people who are involved in the executions are not physicians, and they're not properly trained to do an IV insertion, much less an execution.
Over the years, the issue of medical training led to numerous mistakes. But a watershed moment came in 2009 with the case of Romel Broom in Ohio.
Just 17 steps from the room where he'd be put to death, Romel Broom, convicted of raping and murdering a 14-year-old girl 25 years ago, was helping his executioners. He laid on his side, flexed his muscles to help them find a vein to inject lethal chemicals. Broom never made it out of the preparation chamber.
There were 20 different needle insertions into Mr. Broom in all parts of his body. In the back of his hand, in his arm, in his ankle. Mr. Broom was actually trying to help them find the vein.
After 2 hours, the director of Rehabilitation and Correction made an unprecedented request. He asked the governor to grant a temporary reprieve.
Romel Broom became the only man in U.S. history to walk away from a lethal injection alive.
Romel Broom is still on death row, but he does not have an execution date, and his attorneys are arguing that you can't try and kill someone twice.
But corrections officials in Ohio were undeterred. They devised a new way to kill Romel Broom called Plan B. Most executions use one drug to put the inmate to sleep, a second drug to paralyze the inmate, and finally a third drug to stop the heart. Plan B proposed using a drug called midazolam, injected into the muscles to put the prisoner to sleep. And this invention would open a proverbial Pandora's box of botched executions, starting with Ohio inmate Dennis McGuire.
Dennis McGuire was a human guinea pig for the state of Ohio to experiment on. And it did, in a horrific way.
After the failed lethal injection of Romel Broom, the state of Ohio proposed a new method of execution, using a drug called midazolam. The medical community had immediate concerns.
Traditionally, the first drug was used to induce unconsciousness. Midazolam does not do that. If the inmate is not unconscious and the inmate receives a second drug that paralyzes the muscles, that is a horrible, horrible situation where you are awake, but you cannot move, you cannot breathe. So you have this sensation of suffocating, essentially. And you can't communicate to anybody that this is happening.
Ohio originally proposed using midazolam as a backup plan, but the controversial drug would soon become their only option.
Tonight, U.S. states have been forced to find new drugs for lethal injections since European-based manufacturers banned the U.S. prisons from using their drugs to carry out the death sentence.
The suppliers, most of them in Europe where they don't have the death penalty, said, we will not sell you drugs to kill people. Our drugs are not intended to kill people.
In January 2014, Ohio announced they would try their Plan B drug, midazolam, on inmate Dennis McGuire. McGuire had been convicted of the rape and murder of a housewife named Joy Stewart.
He slashed her throat, severed her jugular. She was carrying a baby.
She was seven months pregnant. Suffocated to death as well.
If you're going to have the death penalty, this guy's the poster child for it, for what he did.
Tim Young represented McGuire in his final appeals.
When we went to court with Mr. McGuire, we argued that midazolam was likely to leave him in severe pain, almost torture, as if he were drowning or unable to breathe and choking and gasping for air.
But arguing the dangers of midazolam presented an unnerving catch-22.
The burden of proof is so high to show that it's going to go bad, it actually has to go bad.
The judge said that this was clearly an experiment, but he likewise said that the inmate was not entitled to a pain-free execution.
The federal court has ruled that they believe the execution will be humane. If I believed that it would not be, we would not be proceeding.
Dennis McGuire was led into the execution chamber on January 16th, 2014.
Dennis McGuire had a very brief but emotional final statement. He said he was sorry for what he had done and he apologized to the family. He mentioned his son and daughter who were there and how he loved them. And then the drugs began flowing.
It typically would have been 5 or 6, maybe 10 minutes, and it would have been all over. But after a few minutes, Dennis McGuire began gasping, kind of wheezing and coughing, sucking in breath. For 13 minutes, his body was struggling not to die. It was obvious that he was trying to get air into his lungs and the drugs were preventing it. And 13 minutes doesn't sound like very long, but if you're watching somebody do that with his family there, it's an eternity. It just went on and on and on. And I'll be candid, as a human being, I was at this point going, please just let him die. Let it stop.
Finally, at 10:53 a.m., Dennis McGuire was declared dead.
Yesterday, I watched the state of Ohio kill my dad. I witnessed his execution along with my wife and my sister. After watching my dad's execution, I know what cruel and unusual punishment is.
Anger bubbled up quickly. This was so foreseeable and so obvious.
The agony and terror of watching my dad suffocate to death lasted more than 19 minutes.
I saw him just gasping for his air. His head kept coming up and his mouth was wide open and he's making all kinds of horrible noises.
We just don't need to do this. There's nothing in the name of the people that justifies this horrible, painful process before dying.
Europe's drug ban soon left other states facing their own drug shortages. And despite Dennis McGuire's botched execution, lessons from midazolam had yet to be learned.
After the McGuire execution, I thought there would be no state that would consider using midazolam, that they would be moving on, and I have since been disabused of that notion.
McGuire was predictable. It was foreseeable. How do you ever go forward after that moment? That's just beyond horrifying to me.
After the botched execution of Dennis McGuire, many thought that the controversial drug midazolam would no longer be used in executions. But less than 6 months later, Arizona announced they would use midazolam on inmate Joseph Wood. Wood was found guilty of murdering his ex-girlfriend and her father in 1989.
We were very aware about what happened with the execution of Dennis McGuire, so we asked the Department of Correction for information about the source of the drugs and the qualifications of the executioners and wardens. And the state of Arizona told us to go pound sand. It would not disclose the source of the drugs, and it said, trust us, the people that are going to be doing this are qualified.
Why all the secrecy? Because I think the Departments of Corrections would like to take care of this ugly little business in as efficient a way as possible. They have a job to do, they have executions to carry out. If people start raising questions about where the drugs come from, who the doctor is, then it slows down the process.
Joseph Wood was taken to the execution chamber at the state penitentiary in Florence on July 23, 2014. At 1:52 p.m., the state of Arizona injected Wood with 50 milligrams of midazolam, 5 times the amount used in Ohio.
Mr. Wood opened his mouth wide and took a very deep breath.
Suddenly, his mouth popped open, like that. And everybody sort of jumped a little bit. You know, hadn't seen that before. You could see a spasm go through his body. You could see it went all the way down to his stomach, gasping like a fish. It was extraordinarily loud. I started doing, you know, hash marks in my notebook. Each time that he would make that sucking sound.
He was gulping, he was gasping, he was struggling to breathe.
I eventually counted 240 hash marks. It went on and on, and I wondered, is someone going to stop this execution? There were 2 lawyers in addition to Dale Bache sitting next to me, and I saw them get up and go out.
1 full hour into the execution, Joseph Wood was still alive. Bache called for the execution to be halted.
We immediately filed a motion with the federal district court asking the federal judge to stop the execution.
They got an assistant attorney general on the phone, and he said he's unconscious. He's not feeling any pain. The judge said, well, do you have an EEG set up to him? Well, no, we don't. Well, so then you don't know.
On the call, the assistant attorney general admitted that a second dose of midazolam had now been given to Wood.
What was not reported was that 14 additional doses of the drug were administered while all this was going on.
Nearly all drugs have what we call a ceiling effect. Even though Joseph Wood received a total of 750 milligrams of midazolam, he was breathing and his heart was working for nearly 2 hours.
Eventually, Joseph Wood's gasping slowed, and it slowed. Then eventually it petered out, and it was done. And then finally, it was over.
After an hour and 57 minutes, Joseph Wood was finally declared dead, becoming one of the longest executions in U.S. history. To many, this was a clear case of cruel and unusual punishment.
Joe Wood is dead, but it took him 2 hours to die. I can't imagine this is what the criminal justice system had hoped for when they came up with this new drug protocol.
There was someone from the attorney general's office who said, oh, it was very peaceful. He was just sleeping and snoring. It's like, no, this is not what it looks like.
The victim's family had little sympathy for Joseph Wood.
Everybody here, from what I heard, said it was excruciating. You don't know what excruciating is. What's excruciating is seeing your dad lying there in a pool of blood, seeing your sister lying there in a pool of blood. That's excruciating. This man deserved it.
This man conducted a horrifying murder. And you guys are going, oh, let's worry about the drug and how he affect. Well, why didn't we give him a bullet? Why didn't we give him some Drano? All you people that think these drugs are bad, well, the hell with you guys.
One of the family members says, what does it matter if it's done with Drano? Well, the answer is we don't do that. This is the United States. We have a constitutional amendment that forbids cruel and unusual punishment. We're supposed to be above that.
With botched executions now spreading, questions mounted about the fate of the 3,000 people remaining on death row. And with the moral implications falling on those normally hidden behind the curtain, the executioners themselves began to speak out.
I just felt like the people have the right to know it's something that's been cloaked in secrecy for years and years and years. I just wanted people to understand, but it's not that I couldn't handle it. It's that I couldn't handle what it turned me into.
When lethal injection became the standard method of capital punishment, the executioners themselves, some with little or no medical training, suffered unintended consequences. Reverend Carol Pickett witnessed 95 executions at the death house in Huntsville, Texas.
We've had guards who will strap people down and faint in the death house. We've had guards come back in to undo the straps, and they freeze because they can't touch death. They come and go quite rapidly. Every couple of weeks, another one would change. And they just couldn't do it.
The life of an executioner is very much a hidden world, literally shrouded in secrecy.
Filmmaker Patty Dillon directed a documentary about executioners titled There Will Be No Stay.
The executioners that I've spent the most time with joined the Department of Corrections and worked their way up from a correctional officer all the way up to a major, which is when they became executioners. And it was the highest promotion. It just happened to include execution.
Among the executioners Patty found were Craig Baxley and Terry Bracey, who carried out executions at the Broad River Prison in South Carolina.
The inmate is less than just a few feet away. The duty that I had was to take the syringe, screw it in, and then do the plunging.
If the inmate does not die within a certain few minutes, then you have to actually do another set. It's not the fact that I couldn't do it, I did it. It's the fact that it changes you psychologically and changes you into a different person. You know, I was not trained to do it, and it messed me up.
Taking that plunger and pushing it in sort of set me on a particular course that I wasn't really prepared for. I expected to be trained. I expected to be counseled. None of that took place.
There's still those fundamental Christian rules of thou shalt not kill. And they're just trapped in their own head with this deep, dark secret of I'm not supposed to be killing people.
I do believe if you've taken some lives, you are a serial killer. I do believe that. But I also look at a serial killer every day when I look in the mirror. I see a serial killer, and there are times when it becomes unbearable.
I haven't met anybody on an execution team that was not experiencing some sort of post-traumatic damage. Some of them survive, and many didn't. Many committed suicide.
The only thing that has kept me from turning into one of these people that you see on the news is I got good professional help and medication and my wife and my children.
These men that we've appointed to keep us safe say, you know, I'm the garbage man taking out your trash or what you're considering to be trash, and it's ruining my life.
The executioners who were in charge of the botched executions in Ohio and Arizona had largely avoided public scrutiny. But in Oklahoma, that would change with the case of Clayton Lockett.
Clayton Lockett was convicted of the murder of 18-year-old Stephanie Neiman. Mr. Lockett shot her with a shotgun, dug a grave, and buried her alive.
I could see her coughing. I could see the dirt coming in the air as she was coughing.
Mr. Lockett confessed to the police. He was convicted. On 19 counts, he received about 2,500 years plus the death penalty.
Facing their own shortage from the European drug ban, Oklahoma announced they would use midazolam on Lockett. And in a rare doubleheader, inmate Charles Warner to be executed the same night.
Both of these crimes, Charles Warner's as well as Clayton Lockett's, were pretty horrific. Charles Warner raped and murdered a baby. So there wasn't a lot of sympathy for either person. The question is whether the process was handled constitutionally and properly.
Susanna Gattoni represented Lockett and Warner.
A law had been passed in Oklahoma in 2011, which made the source of drugs completely secret. But if my clients are not being rendered unconscious, that's cruel and unusual punishment. So I tried to show that this statute is unconstitutional because it prohibits Mr. Lockett, Mr. Warner, anyone from finding out where those drugs came from.
In fact, Gattoni discovered Oklahoma had planned to execute Lockett and Warner with drugs purchased in a potentially illegal manner.
Some correspondents from the Attorney General's office admitted that the drugs were coming from a compounding pharmacy, which is not regulated by the FDA.
Compounding pharmacies or neighborhood pharmacies in some cases that typically don't do this kind of thing at all. They do small drugs, lotions and creams and other sort of simple things.
Compounding pharmacies don't traditionally make intravenous compounds. That's not what they're for.
Nobody really oversees what is in the compound. Nobody oversees if, in fact, the drug will do what it's supposed to do.
If the state of Oklahoma is buying drugs from a compounding pharmacy without a doctor-patient relationship, then that would mean that they're violating federal law, criminal law.
In December of 2013, a court in Missouri ordered the release of records detailing transactions with a compounding pharmacy in Oklahoma.
Officials from the state of Missouri Department of Corrections went to Oklahoma to obtain drugs from a compounding pharmacy, apparently taking $11,000 in cash and buying it from a company in Oklahoma that wasn't licensed to do business in Missouri.
It's like a shady drug deal. Suddenly you've got people carrying cash in the night across state lines so that the public doesn't know how or where $11,000 in taxpayer money was spent. Abide by the Constitution in the full light of day, in front of everybody, like our justice system's supposed to.
Missouri officials were accused of buying drugs from a compounding pharmacy named the Apothecary Shop in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Email chains also revealed secret agreements between the apothecary shop and prison officials in Louisiana and Georgia, where the pharmacy was also unlicensed to do business.
It's almost a cloak and dagger way of trying to get drugs to use for executions. I think the real reason for all the secrecy that's happening now is states are at the end of their rope, so to speak. They've tried everything. This is like their last-ditch effort to proceed with executions.
With less than 24 hours to go, the Oklahoma Supreme Court agreed to hear Susanna Gattoni's argument and granted Clayton Lockett and Charles Warner a rare stay of execution. That decision would set off one of the biggest political firestorms in state history.
These are evildoers. These are animals. You can call them demons if you may. We want justice.
Oklahoma Supreme Court had granted Clayton Lockett and Charles Warner a rare stay of execution in order to hear Susanna Gattoni's argument against secrecy laws that allowed the state to mask their source of execution drugs. Political reaction was swift and forceful.
I believe the death penalty is an appropriate response and punishment to those who commit heinous crimes against their fellow men and women.
The very next day, Governor Fallon issued an executive order, which essentially said she didn't believe that the Oklahoma Supreme Court had jurisdiction to do what they did. She was trying to override, usurp what the court had done.
The governor said that the Supreme Court had exceeded its authority. I don't know that that's ever happened in Oklahoma, and no one really questioned whether she had the authority to do that or not. All the Supreme Court was really asking for was more time for the attorneys in the case to brief these issues.
Reaction also came from state representative and former police officer Mike Christian, who immediately introduced legislation to impeach the judges who'd voted in favor of Lockett and Warner.
The way I see it, these are evildoers, these are animals, you can call them demons if you may, and the people across this country, in particular Oklahoma, we want justice.
People in Oklahoma strongly support the death penalty. They feel we don't spend enough time talking about the victims of these crimes. An 18-year-old girl ends up being savagely duct-taped, shot, and buried alive. And we're talking about Mr. Lockett and his rights.
Mike Christian is a very pro-death penalty lawmaker, as many are in Oklahoma. Christian and several others proposed articles of impeachment. At that point, we had a major controversy in our hands between our branches of government.
Faced with impeachment and a battle against the governor, the Oklahoma Supreme Court now had second thoughts.
The very next day, the Oklahoma Supreme Court dissolved their stay, said that the secrecy statute was constitutional, and called our claim frivolous.
In their ruling dissolving their own stay, they seemed kind of peeved that this process was rushed, but people are calling for their impeachment.
I felt very disappointed in myself. I was reminded of something my stepfather, who was a lawyer, told me once when I was in law school stressing. He said to me, "Susanna, just remember, no matter what you do, no one will die." And in this instance, that wasn't true.
At the Oklahoma State Penitentiary on April 29, 2014, Clayton Lockett was led to the execution chamber while Charles Warner waited in the wings. Ziva Brandstetter witnessed Lockett's execution.
The Clayton Lockett execution was my fourth execution to witness. It was scheduled for 6 p.m. Eventually, they roll up the shades at 6:20. Lockett was asked if he had a last statement, and he just said no.
At 6:23 p.m., Lockett was injected with midazolam to render him unconscious.
At 6:31, the doctor checked consciousness, and the warden announced that the inmate was still conscious. A few minutes later, the doctor checked consciousness again and said the inmate is unconscious.
A second drug was injected, intended to paralyze Lockett.
At 6:33, I noticed a reaction. There was a kicking of his leg. Clayton Lockett began to strain against the restraints. His body began to kind of buck. He was struggling and writhing. He looked like he was trying to get up off the gurney to me. It was really very shocking. It was clear to me that Clayton Lockett was still conscious. It was clear to me that he was in pain. I heard him say, "Man," you know, like he was shocked at whatever it was that he was feeling, and he was lifting his head up and shoulders clear off the gurney, mumbling, "Something is wrong." And then the warden said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we need to temporarily close the blinds." and they closed the blinds and shut off the mic.
I sat next to the victim's family at the execution. No one knew if he had died or if he lived or what was happening. They were concerned about that.
The attorneys who are witnessing this on behalf of Clayton Lockett said they're going to revive him so they can kill him another day.
The blinds would not reopen. And at 6:56 p.m., Clayton Lockett's execution was officially halted.
We were taken back to the media witness center, but there was no clear discussion of what was going on with Clayton Lockett.
Is Lockett dead, or
do we don't know we don't the know. Status right now.
We don't know the status.
Breaking news from the state prison in McAllister.
The first of two scheduled executions at the prison did not go as planned.
Clayton Lockett was supposed to receive the death penalty for killing a woman 15 years ago. But tonight, his punishment is being referred to as a botched execution.
Things obviously went horribly wrong with Mr. Lockett's execution. My assistant reached me and told me that I needed to turn on a TV to see what was happening. The reports were that he was still alive.
At 7:23 p.m., the man in charge of Lockett's execution, Department of Corrections Director Robert Patton, addressed the media.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to make a short statement. I will not be taking any questions, so please don't scream and holler at me. As those that were inside witnessed, the drugs were not having the effect. So the doctor observed the line and determined that the line had blown. It was my decision at that time to stop the execution. At approximately 7:06 hours, inmate suffered what appears to be a massive heart attack and passed away.
Why did you decide to lower the curtain?
So the physician could check the vein.
What was the line blown?
The vein blew.
The vein.
Yes.
Lockett's vein.
Yes.
So blue.
What does that mean?
It means the vein exploded.
His vein exploded.
Yes.
He said his vein exploded, which I thought was a really strange explanation because veins don't generally explode.
The truth would only be revealed after months of investigation. But in the meantime, just down the hall from the death chamber, Charles Warner had eaten his last meal. Warner's family and lawyers were now told that his execution would proceed. After the botched execution of Clayton Lockett, Charles Warner, scheduled to die immediately after Lockett, was left in the dark. His family waited to attend his execution.
The family was very, very deep and devout prayer. The mother, of course, was sobbing through her prayers. It was very sad. We waited for a long time. It became time for Charles's execution, and we were still sitting in that room, and nobody was telling us anything. Then another attorney came rushing into our room and said there was not going to be an execution for Charles Warner that night. The family was crying with joy. Mrs. Warner said, you know, those prayers were heard by a higher being. We were so relieved.
But the mood soon turned sour as prison officials seemed confused about what exactly was going on.
We were going to go home. We were led out to the parking lot, and we started to get in the car. Well, out of the building ran the warden yelling at us, get back into this building. You're breaking protocol. You have to get back into the building.
Prison officials now told Warner's family the execution would proceed.
I was horrified. We went back into the building, and then we sat there for a while, not knowing if Charles Warner would be executed. I was angry and perplexed. It was too late to go file anything in the court. We had no phone. Finally, at some point, we were told that Charles Warner would not be executed, and we were told to go home. It was an incredible roller coaster of emotions.
Investigations into the botched execution of Clayton Lockett eventually revealed what happened behind the blinds.
We later learned that the doctor who was supposed to perform the execution had backed out 2 days before Clayton Lockett's execution, and this other doctor, who had only performed one other execution in the state, stepped in. The doctor made 12 attempts to start an IV, and it was not properly inserted. The drugs were not delivered into his vein. They went into the tissue. There were no backup drugs that night. There was no emergency plan if something went wrong.
Regarding the use of midazolam, Mike Oakley from the corrections department said, I looked online, you know, went past the key WikiLeaks or whatever it is, and I did find out midazolam would render a person unconscious. So we thought it was okay.
Obviously, they need someone who is better equipped at knowing if someone is rendered unconscious.
After hitting an artery causing Lockett's blood to spray, the doctor who executed Lockett said he hoped to, quote, get enough money out of this to go buy a new jacket.
What happened in Oklahoma is deeply troubling.
Clayton Lockett's case would bring worldwide attention to America's botched executions and questions about the future of lethal injection.
Human rights outrage
after botching the delivery of a new untested combination of drugs.
Clayton Lockett was still said to be shaking uncontrollably 20 minutes after the first drug was administered.
You've got amateur hour going on here. You're having someone poorly trained brew up something in the back, so to speak, in the kitchen, say, I've never tried this before, let's see how it goes.
And voices on both sides of the issue responded forcefully.
The fact that there may be some pain during the process does not offend me. I don't think it offends most of the people in Oklahoma.
Why are we designing the most pleasant death possible for people who have imposed the most unpleasant death possible?
I want them to sit back and think, if that was your child, would you have sympathy?
It took 2 hours for this man to die. This guy snored on his way to hell.
It wasn't an execution. This man was killed by malpractice of a doctor, was killed by negligence of the states.
The death penalty is a government program, and the government takes them a week to deliver a piece of mail. What gives us the idea that the government can make life and death decisions with life and death accuracy?
Lockett should be given the same mercy that he gave his victim, Stephanie. And that would be none.
Our constitutional rights are with us until we die. We shouldn't dismiss them because we think the person who's being executed isn't deserving.
We are saying to the world, this is done as a considered, thoughtful moment of punishment, not as some rageful, heinous act. If that's the punishment we're imposing, then we're him. We're the heinous murderer.
Time is running out for convicted killer Charles Warner, set to die at 6 p.m. in the state's first execution since last April.
9 months after Clayton Lockett's execution, Oklahoma completed construction on a brand new death chamber, which they were now ready to use on Charles Warner.
The microphone will come on and the staff member will read the warrant of execution to the offender. The offender will be allowed to make a last statement. The first drug in a three-drug protocol, midazolam, will be administered.
But Warner's defense team had filed one last plea for a stay of execution with the U.S. Supreme Court, claiming the use of midazolam was a violation of the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Meanwhile, the mother of Warner's victim, an 11-month-old baby, made her feelings clear.
If they truly want to honor me, then they will give him life in prison without the possibility of parole. I don't see any justice in just sentencing someone to die. To me, the justice is in someone living with what they have done to you, to your family, and having to live with that for the rest of their life, knowing that they'll never walk out those bars. When he dies, I want it to be because it's his time, not because he's been executed due to what happened to me and my child. And I don't want that on my hands. It makes me feel like I'm no different than him, and I don't want to feel that way.
The time for Warner's execution came and went as Oklahoma waited for word from the U.S. Supreme Court about whether they could use midazolam on Warner. At 6:20 p.m., the decision came down. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote, "The Food and Drug Administration has not approved midazolam for use as an anesthetic. The Eighth Amendment guarantees that no one should be subjected to an execution that causes searing, unnecessary pain before death." But Justice Sotomayor's opinion was in the minority.
Ladies and gentlemen, the U.S. Supreme Court has denied the stay of execution. The process will begin shortly. I need the witnesses to prepare themselves for transport.
Everything are you talking this time?